It's Wednesday, August 18th, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, we'll talk about the fall of Afghanistan, the fears crushing Afghans, the journalists trying to get out, and the reactions here at home to the end of this 20-year war. The site so many turn to for verification, Snopes, it's removed one of its co-founders, suspended that person after it was discovered he'd plagiarized dozens of articles published to that site. And
the category for Final Jeopardy is Around the World. Here is the clue.
And that voice belongs to Mayim Bialik. She will be one of the two hosts of Jeopardy. It was a decision made last week that left a lot of people with more questions than answered. How very Jeopardy-like. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but I want to really go back to and start with the Taliban's takeover of Kabul, the end of our 20 years war in that country. Sunday morning, Secretary of State Antony Blinken was on CNN's State of the Nation. Here's what he had to say to Jake Tapper.
This is not just about the overall idea of leaving Afghanistan. This is about leaving hastily and ineptly. Secretary Blinken, how did President Biden get this so wrong?
Jake, first, let's put this in context. And as we've discussed before, we were in Afghanistan for one overriding purpose, to deal with the folks who attacked us on 9/11. That's why we went there 20 years ago. And over those 20 years, we brought bin Laden to justice. We vastly diminished the threat posed by al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to the United States to the point where it's not capable of conducting such an attack again from Afghanistan. We're going to keep in place in the region the capacity to see if any reemergence of a terrorist threat and to be able to deal with it. And on the terms that we went into Afghanistan in the first place, we've succeeded in achieving our objectives.
So I guess I can see where he's coming from, but at the same time, in my mind's eye, I keep seeing George Bush standing on an aircraft carrier with a mission accomplished banner, thinking about the video we saw of people running on a tarmac alongside a plane attempting to taxi, some of this other video. To me, that's not the image of what looks like outcomes achieved.
Well, I think certainly President Biden, I think, was a far better spokesman for himself than Secretary Blinken in that clip. He gave a pretty forceful speech later in the week that I think made a pretty strong case for what he decided to do. And I think ultimately it is a popular decision, because I think we have to remember that leading figures in both parties, including President Biden's predecessor, two guys who don't usually agree, all agreed that we should leave Afghanistan. I think what's been rough about this is the way we left, which was the point Jake Tapper was making. And those images are harrowing, because you see that what happens when America pulls out of a situation like that, and the bare equilibrium that we provided there falls apart. And I gotta say, anybody who sees those pictures of people frantically trying to clamber aboard a taxiing U.S. Air Force plane have got to say, you know, for me as an American, it makes me get down on my hands and knees and say, thank God I was born in this country, because you realize how desperate people are to be in a place like this.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, I looked at that and I went, you know, how else did we think this was going to end? Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as a managed withdrawal when you have supported a government that, if you go back and look at it over the 20 years that we were there, there was corruption before we got there, there was corruption the whole time we were there, and there's still corruption there. So this was not going to be some sort of managed pageantry of a withdrawal that some people may have imagined in their heads. It was going to be messy. I think what really surprised people is that it happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. But if you listen to the experts, none of them were surprised that this happened as quickly as it happened, that the Afghan army fell as quickly as it did, because in theory, it was being propped up by the U.S. And, you know, once the Taliban started moving throughout the country, many of those same Afghan soldiers that had been trained joined the Taliban.
So would you say, Ernest, that the coverage of that foreign policy decision has been fair to Biden and to the administration?
I think it's fair to what's happening on the ground. I don't think you can sit back and say whether it was fair to President Biden, whether it was fair to former President Trump, Obama, Bush. It is what it is. This is the reality of the situation. And I think what happens is that you have you have journalists and really what I have to catch myself in calling them journalists. You have a Jake Tapper that says, how could we get it so wrong? Mm-hmm. Did we get it wrong? We couldn't manage this. There was no way for the United States to manage this when it happened over the weekend.
Yeah, well, I think a couple of things. One, I think a lot of journalists have a lot of skin in this game because a lot of us know people who were put at risk by the speed at which things collapsed in Afghanistan. So we know people or know people who know people who are in grave danger in Afghanistan mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. of this. So I think there's a natural emotional reaction, and I think it's important for audiences to understand that. Having said that, it's a natural emotional reaction. Yeah. Look at what we're seeing. I mean, the human, it's not just whether you know a journalist who's in Kabul, it's whether you look at what's happening to people, and I think this is the painful part of it. We were involved in Afghanistan so long. One of our student journalists has been interviewing Missouri veterans, mm-hmm. and reading through those transcripts is really painful because you get a sense, these veterans don't want us to stay in Afghanistan, but they made personal relationships while we were there, and they're thinking about what's going to happen to those people now.
And to me, those are the stories. I mean, those are the ones that I've really paid attention to, is what are the people who have been there or the people who have lost loved ones there, what do they think about this? And overall, what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing and what I'm reading is that they wanted us out of there a long time ago, but they want to be recognized for what it has done to their lives, those who are still with us and those whose families are still, sort of dealing with that. I think that's the story that I don't think we should miss out of this. And going back to the point that you made, Kathy, about the people who are still there.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. There are actually two different groups of people I would want to talk about who are still there. And I want to start with those who worked on behalf of either the U.S. government or who worked alongside U.S. journalists or journalists from anywhere that were there from other countries, who are really at this point at great risk. They're being hunted down.
Yeah, I mean, we saw there was a letter this week from the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. Jointly, the publishers wrote to the State Department saying, please help us get our people out. And they said there were more than 200 people, mm-hmm. just those three organizations. So imagine the TV networks and beyond. It takes, I think the one, journalism is a labor-intensive job. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people were involved on the ground and trying to get them out. The problem is the Taliban has blockaded the airport, from what we're hearing. I mean, you have to go through checkpoints to get to the airport. So can we rely on the Taliban to keep their promise to give free passage to people? I don't know why I feel a little skeptical about that.
And you should feel skeptical about that. I mean, I think that's what the issue is. And we're just talking about the journalists. I mean, what about those who aided the journalists?
That's what I'm thinking about, the translators, the fixers, the bodyguards.
Well, I think that 240 people, and I think all of those people are marked.
Yeah, we're not in, as you say, you're just talking about those three organizations. I mean, what about those who worked for the British and the Canadians and the Australians and others who are allies in it? They're all having to deal with that same issue right now because many of those countries that already left, mm-hmm. and it was the United States that was keeping things going, but those journalists and those translators and those fixers, they were all still there, and now they're trying to get out. I think this is a situation where you're gonna
And they're citizens of that country, right?
Absolutely.
It's not as though they have another, you know, that they don't have access to another passport. It's not as though, you know, there's perhaps a friendly nation or an ally that still has an embassy there that could help negotiate passage. They're stuck. And they're being hunted.
Right. And what you're going to see over the course of probably years is they're going to be trying to figure out ways to get out through refugee points, maybe through, because right now what they're saying is the only viable country that's going to have a relationship with the Taliban is China. So, and China doesn't have a very good track record in human rights and helping people to relocate to other countries. So it's going to be very difficult for them to get out once the Americans have completely pulled out.
So one of the other comparisons that has been made has been the fall of Kabul to the fall of Saigon. I'm going to ask you, Ernest, you're our historian here. Is it a fair comparison? Is it that similar situation?
The images are similar.
Yeah.
But the context is different.
Okay.
You have a different context here than what you had there. In terms of the war itself, the context around it, back in Vietnam, there wasn't a direct assault on the United States by actors from within Vietnam. You had that situation
at the beginning of this from
9/11. So you have that factor playing into it. You had more of an orderly withdrawal out of Vietnam than you had here, even though the images seemed to be similar. In fact, you had most of the troops and everyone else had already left Saigon and Vietnam by the time those last images showed up. That wasn't the case here. A lot of the troops had left, but you still got this crazy sort of exodus going on right now that appears to be out of control and no one's paying attention to it. So that's a part of the issue there. And there was a negotiated between all the parties, a negotiated movement out of Vietnam. This was not, they're still trying to negotiate the Taliban taking that country over, even though from a military mm-hmm. perspective, the Taliban have done that. So, I mean, you've got a lot of differences here that's difficult to put in a story that appears on the nightly news at 5:30.
I do think there's one similarity, though, that just haunts me.
Yeah.
I keep thinking back to the great, great book by a journalist, Francis Fitzgerald, about Vietnam called Fire in the Lake. And that was really a groundbreaking book that I think explained why the United States couldn't win the war, because it talked about being in a very different culture, trying to impose U.S. expectations and mores on a very different culture. And it was just a brilliant exposition. And clearly not enough people in Washington, D.C. have read that book. And I highly recommend it. Francis Fitzgerald, right. Fire in the Lake.
Right. There's another book called Caravan. I can't remember the author's name.
Well, you guys are giving me some great things to add to the links blog.
That talks about Afghanistan. It was written back in the 70s. And it sort of lays out how, for most of its history, it has fought various wars to keep foreigners out of Afghanistan. The Russians, then the Americans. And before that,
The British.
So, I mean, that's the one thing. The one constant here is that
We
didn't learn from history. Our own history and others' history.
Okay. Kathy, I want to take a minute to provide folks with an update on another story. It's a case we've been following here, one that you have been involved with. Talk for a minute about a decision in the Philippines to drop one of those libel charges against Maria Ressa.
Yeah, well, Maria Ressa, who has been really under siege by the government there, Rodrigo Duterte, the strongman dictator, and one of the tactics that they're using to try to silence, they pulled the license of the nation's biggest broadcaster. They can't do that to an internet site, so one of the tactics they're using is filing legal case after legal case. Two of those cases have been dismissed, so those are two big victories. The second one was this week, but Maria still hasn't won the war. She's got a lot of other cases that she's fighting. She's got a lot of support from human rights advocates and press freedom organizations, but that's a fight that keeps going.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that one too. Monday night, Chris Cuomo returned from what audiences were told was a scheduled vacation. And toward the end of the show, he finally broke his silence on the scandal that led to his brother's resignation of the governor as the governor of New York.
I've told you, it's never easy being in this business and coming from a political family, especially now. This situation is unlike anything I could have imagined. And yet I know what matters at work and at home. Everyone knows you support your family. I know and appreciate that you get that. But you should also know I never covered my brother's troubles because I obviously have a conflict. And there are rules at CNN about that. I said last year that his appearances on this show would be short-lived. And they were. The last was over a year ago, long before any kind of scandal. I also said back then that a day would come when he would have to be held to account, and I can't do that. I said point blank, I can't be objective when it comes to my family. So I never reported on the scandal. And when it happened, I tried to be there for my brother. I'm not an advisor. I'm a brother. I wasn't in control of anything. I was there to listen and offer my take. And my advice to my brother was simple and consistent. Own what you did. Tell people what you'll do to be better. Be contrite. And finally, accept that it doesn't matter what you intended. What matters is how your actions and words were perceived.
So, Ernest, we have talked about this conflict of interest so many times, even going back to the interviews he was talking about a year ago when Governor Cuomo was being looked at as the beacon for the management of COVID, only to be scandalized by the nursing home numbers. Your response to Chris Cuomo's statement, if you will, I don't know if I want to call it an excuse, an explanation, or whatever.
Well, I mean, I think he handled it about as well as he could. Uh-huh. But as far as I'm concerned, the blame for all of this as it relates to Chris Cuomo is CNN.
Yeah.
They've had numerous opportunities to deal with this situation and chose not to. And the only reason you could come up with until they give another one is his ratings. And the fact that he draws in a lot of people because of some of the scandal.
Which is interesting because CNN's ratings, really since the election, especially in prime time, have tanked.
Yeah.
And that audience isn't there in the same way. So, Kathy, if you're Jeff Zucker, is it time for him to go?
Well, you know,
you just don't want to be Jeff Zucker.
I definitely don't want to be Jeff Zucker for a whole host of reasons. Right. But remember, this is also the network that brought back Jeffrey Toobin, talked about.
That's
so this is there's a tolerance there for
shenanigans.
Yeah, or not towing the line. But I would say the big mistake. You know, obviously you can't blame somebody for what his brother did, but his explanation there of I was just being a brother, that doesn't square with
evidence. No, it doesn't with me
all.
Either.
And so I think that's disingenuous. Yeah, and so I think he clearly can't cover the story. How do you do a primetime show,
a new show, not cover the story?
You bring in a second anchor, maybe. But it's. Yeah, I mean, there are solutions for this. But
they need some creative producers, we help develop those here.
It's frustrating because CNN had a way out of this.
Many
it
ways.
Just didn't take
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
You know, that's the thing that's most frustrating. I mean, we're sitting here talking about Chris Cuomo, but really, it's CNN. They could have brought in another anchor, as you said. They could have changed the format of the show, going all the way back even prior to the pandemic when he was having conflicts of interest revolving around his brother and other family.
They could have had that show take on a different tone or cover other events that weren't related to COVID or weren't related to politics for weeks or months at a time. If they were to take an hour to spend doing local reporting on COVID in a different market every night, or just think of different ways to cover it that weren't focusing on New York.
Right, and
New
be
York
transparent
politics.
About it. Say, we're not doing this because obviously mm-hmm. the guy can't cover his brother. But when you already brought the brother on your air, and that was the first violation when back when then Governor Cuomo was a hero.
Right. And it was a
and you
was
used
cute
him as a cute
between
yes.
the brothers.
And
yeah.
then you've already gone down the slippery slope. So, I mean, it's the problem, I think, if we were going to label it, it's mixing news and entertainment.
Okay, so if we're going to do that and talk about mixing news and entertainment and going after the big bucks, we're going to pick on CNN, we're going to talk about Fox News too, and we're going to talk about Tucker Carlson's trip last week to Hungary, which was pretty much an infomercial for it was kind of a junket and a infomercial for an oppressive regime and a dictator.
I mean, the thing about all of this is that it all revolves around personalities and creating these sort of narratives that have almost a soap opera like environment involving the anchor and whoever happens to be on at the time or whatever dictated country they happen to visit. Or
yeah, well, it's like the flying Wallendas. Yes. Will he fall off the tightrope?
Right.
And is there a safety net? that was just absolutely bizarre. It's like we're now going in for oppressive, dictatorial, anti-free press regimes. That's
so,
the new
so
brand?
Let me ask you. Okay, so here's what I want to ask you to kind of counteract that. I'm going to make all of the puns in the world. I've already made one Jeopardy pun, right?
I use goulash.
Okay, well, okay. Oh, good. Hungry. I get that now. but let's talk about fair and balanced. Fox News's motto, slogan. Is there a way a network could have done a fair and balanced remote broadcast from Hungary for a week?
I'm still trying to figure out why the heck they went to Hungary. Regardless of whether it's fair and balanced, why did you even go? There's nothing happening there that would dictate you spending that amount of money and airtime for your top person to go to Hungary. We still are trying to deal with an imploding Afghanistan and a pandemic.
Why are we in Hungary?
Yes, in Hungary?
Exactly. But to answer your question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
But excellent point, Ernest. But to answer your question, sure, if you talked to some of the people, told the stories of the people whom Viktor Orban has jailed, mm-hmm. if you talked about the press, the journalists he's muzzling, and talked about why he might be doing that, sure, you could do a fair and balanced story if to Ernest's point, anybody cares in this week of, in addition to COVID and Afghanistan, thousands of people have been dying in Haiti. So,
The earthquake in Haiti, too, we haven't been able
to
talk
about. So why are we doing
today?
This? And I think Ernest's point that you made earlier was this is it's a show. It's kind of our man in Hungary. Look, Tucker got this invitation, and let's tag along with them. I mean, there's something like really Robin Leach, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, about this whole thing.
You're right.
Lifestyles of the...
of the autocratic dictatorial.
Exactly. Thank
okay.
you.
We've fallen
exhausted
off the edge today, yes. Okay, so it's one of the go-to sites that the internet turns to find out whether something is true or not. Snopes, right? We've all looked up something on Snopes. Well, this week, the site has retracted more than 50 stories and has labeled as many as another 140 as problematic after co-founder David Mickelson was discovered to have plagiarized work he put on the site. Now, BuzzFeed News was the site that broke this story wide open. What did they find?
Well, basically what they found was that he was lifting stories from other news sites and journalists and all sorts of things. And now one of our former graduates, who is the managing editor, mm-hmm. I think that's her title, is Doreen Marchioni,
yes.
is now investigating that. But he owns 50% of the company. And his excuse was, well, I'm not a trained journalist, so I didn't know. How many times have we heard that before? You just don't understand it. All you
have dozens of students I turn in every year for plagiarism in non-journalism courses understand the concept. You don't have to be a trained journalist to understand the concept
of plagiarism. If you're using someone else's material.
Cheating and stealing are pretty well-known concepts across the population. Right, yeah.
So he has said to Marchione that she can do whatever he deems necessary at this point. What does that look like?
Yeah, well, that's weird. I feel I'm very glad that we have a Missouri-trained journalist trying to clean up this mess, but she's got a big job, and it's particularly an awkward job because he's still a co-owner.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you clean up the owner's mess? Yeah. I do think, you know, clearly there's a great financial and reputational incentive for him to give her free hand to clean things up, and I would hope so. I mean, this fact-checking is important. There are a lot of people who want to take pot shots at fact-checkers, and this certainly doesn't help the cause.
Not at all. Not at all.
Before we go, it's official. Alex Trebek's replacement is the host of Jeopardy! Is, well, it's two people. And it's two people that people don't seem to be too excited about. Mike Richards is the show's executive producer, and he will be the new host of the nationally syndicated show that you're used to seeing on KOMU here in Mid-Missouri.
Jeopardy! Is an incredibly important American institution. It's about making people that are smart, the most important people in the room.
And Mayim Bialik, Amy Farrah Fowler from Big Bang Theory and Blossom from the 90s NBC sitcom. She's also a neuroscientist. She is going to host a new primetime spinoff. Now, neither one of them are LeVar Burton, and he was really the popular choice among audiences.
Yeah, and personally, I think he should have gotten the position because I think, number one, the popularity, and it would have, I think, pulled Jeopardy! Into a modern era. I don't have a problem with Mayim coming in as a host when they do something national and that sort of thing. But for the producer to put himself in a position, it's sort of like that whole...
So can I host the new the primetime spinoff of Views of the News in the game show format?
Well, it reminded me of when back when I covered the George W. Bush's search for a vice president, and Dick Cheney, who was the head of the search committee, ended up being the nominee. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Same thing.
It was a golden opportunity to do that. But also, you know, to be serious here, it's sort of that insider baseball kind of thing here, where here's an opportunity for, you know, Hollywood and game shows to make a change, and instead the person sort of inserts himself. There are people out there who are basically saying, you know, this is the kind of thing that we're trying to move away from, but it seems like for every one step we take forward, we take two steps back because someone wants to remain in control.
So that raises another interesting point, right? So think back to the 70s and the 80s, and daytime TV was game shows, right? Like that was the thing. Today, we're pretty much left on a daily syndicated game show app menu, if you will, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we've got Jeopardy, we've got Wheel of Fortune, and The Price is Right. Am I missing anything else?
Pretty much, I said, maybe Family Feud, which is really the only one
Family
that
Feud.
Has a diverse
host. Yes, that has, thank you for reminding me about Family Feud. Is this a missed opportunity that maybe kind of sort of puts Jeopardy in the extinction pile? Is this going to go the way of Card Sharks?
It depends on how the host
does. To tell the truth?
It depends on how the host does. It really does. I mean,
are you going to be tuning in to watch this guy?
No.
But I do think what you said, it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a missed opportunity to modernize the look of the show and to broaden the audience. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tab at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads to listen on demand. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program. Again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, Kyle Felling for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing our theme music.